Hello, this is Richard Davis, welcoming you to another edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. Coming up in the next hour, we'll be hearing from a man who believes that he can predict what's coming up in the way of technological developments in the next 10 years. Then we'll be hearing about a survey conducted by one of Britain's oldest funeral directors, who happened to be based locally, into the attitudes that people have towards the way that they'd like to be remembered after their death. On a more cheerful note, we'll be hearing about online music lessons, which anybody over the age of 18 can take part in, and about an outdoor activity particularly popular with men, which has been around for centuries, but is staging something of a comeback in popularity due to the pandemic. As usual, we'll be giving out various email addresses, website addresses and telephone numbers during the course of the programme, so you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. So let's start with our predictions for the technological future. One man who makes a living out of predicting the future in this way is Tom Cheesewright, who describes himself as an applied futurologist. When I spoke to him, I began by asking what a futurologist is.
So I work with organisations around the world, Hive in this case, to help them to see what's coming next and work out what to do about it in some cases as well. I get involved in seeing what's next, but also making the plans to deal with it.
And what do you base your predictions on?
Well, I mean, you know, futurists started just by telling stories and trying to explore different ideas, but we do have some tools. In this case, we're looking at the relatively near future. So what I'm looking for is the intersection between some of the pressures and challenges we face today, like climate change, with the incoming trends in terms of technology, culture, and the economy. And wherever those two meet, that's where you tend to see these big sort of changes, these big shifts happening.
You think that our homes are going to be considerably more automated in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting what we can see from the research is how much has changed already. Around 70% of us already have some sort of smart home technology, whether that's, you know, controlling your heats and your lights or a sort of smart alarm, or if it's actually, you know, something like a voice assistant that more and more of us have these days.
And you're talking about things like heat pumps and smart water tanks, all sorts of amazing things. But all this is going to cost quite a lot of money, isn't it? Which is all very well for the well-off. But what about poorer people?
No, you're absolutely right. You know, I think, you know, what's interesting is that 88% of us want to live more sustainably, but that can feel quite inaccessible. And it led to a level of pessimism amongst our survey respondents about how likely it is that their homes could be more efficient by 2030. And I think, you know, what we've got to do is show people the small steps they can take, the small affordable steps they can take, particularly ones that pay for themselves. So you take something like, you know, taking control of your heating. You're not just relying on your sort of old analog thermostat, but actually being able to control your heating to make sure that it's not wasted energy. That can maybe save you £120 a year, and you're only looking at about £90 for the actual technology. So it's a small step. You know, is it as big a step as the big investments you could make in your house and making it more efficient? Maybe not, but you're immediately seeing the impact in your bills. You've got that extra little bit of luxury from the remote control as well, and you're starting to bring down your carbon footprint.
But do you think that some people are going to need government subsidies in order to install this sort of technology?
Yeah, I think it may be the case. I mean, I think we'll get there in the end anyway. There is a natural replacement cycle, so we're going to be replacing this technology as it wears out. If we want to get there quickly, then yeah, by all means, yeah, we could put more money into it. But the thing we know about technology is we watch its progress. Is it always gets more powerful, it always gets more capable, but it always gets cheaper as well. These things do come down in price over time. And the smart home's a great example. You know, rewind 20, 30 years, it used to be what I call footballer tech. You know, it's the sort of things you can only afford if you had £10,000-£20,000 a week in disposable income, whereas now it's the sort of thing you can pick up on the high street for a few pounds and install yourself.
My programme is intended mainly for older listeners, and I'm wondering how easily some older people are going to be able to adapt to modern technology, given the fact that many older people can't really cope with the smart technology we've got around at the moment.
Well, you say that, but the last year has been a real sort of catalyst for people adopting technology. You know, take as a good example, online grocery shopping, you know, something maybe people weren't thinking about pre-lockdown. Spending by over 65s online groceries went up 300% during that period. And so people, you know, saw a need, saw the technology, overcame their fears in order to use it, just like they did with video calling, the way you and I are chatting now. You know, not something you necessarily wanted, needed when you could pop round and see the grandkids. But if you can't, then you get over that fear and you use that technology to do so. And I think the same thing will happen with smart home technologies. There's this whole sort of ecosystem of technologies now that are there, they're accessible, they're available. People maybe haven't because of that bit of fear, but once you're used to using a smartphone, they really are quite easy, and they do have that dual benefit, if you like, of potentially saving on your bills and potentially fulfilling that desire to cut your carbon footprint.
Aren't we going to need a huge investment in the internet in order for all this to happen, given that at the moment there are places in the country where you can't get a decent broadband?
Yeah, you know, and that's a running problem when I speak to people who live, you know, sort of further out from the cities. It remains a challenge. It is improving. Yeah, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that should help is the investment in 5G, not necessarily 5G itself, but actually because we're rolling out 5G, we're putting lots more fiber in the ground, more connection to places, and we may see spurs off that, giving people good broadband at home. But we're getting there to a level of penetration now where you can, you know, in most places there are obviously rural exceptions where you can assume a level of connectivity. And inside your home is the critical bit. If you've got a good Wi-Fi signal, then all of these smart technologies will work.
Well, they're all right until they break down, aren't they?
Well, it's true of all technologies. You know, we've always traded the possibility of failure for the benefits that they bring while they're running. And the reliability of technology has improved along with its power over the last 50, 60 years. I mean, I think cars are a great example. You know, I have very strong memories of my dad having to whip the battery out to charge it, or even stick the spark plugs in his, you know, Cavalier GSI and into the vise and heat them up on a cold day to get the car running. These days, there's a big plastic sheet over the top of it and you never even look inside. And the same thing's happened with the smart home. When I was mucking around with this technology 20 years ago, it was incredibly flaky. These days, it's incredibly reliable.
One other slight problem is computerizing everything, putting everything onto a big Internet of Things, perhaps. Doesn't that leave us wide open to computer hackers and people who want to destroy the networks and create chaos?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's always a risk there as we computerize more things. And this battle been going on for years between those trying to defend our networks and those trying to assault them. By and large, those trying to defend the networks are winning. You know, the fact that you and I are chatting now, that we can rely on these technologies, you know, 99.9% of the time, means that actually by and large, the good guys are winning on this. Is there a risk factor? Absolutely, the same as there is with all technology and all connected technology. But, you know, the general standards of reliability, I think, are incredibly robust. You know, there are more incidents of squirrels taking down sort of power networks than international terrorists. So you know, I think we have to be sort of cautious about our caution.
Now, all this is going to take a few years to come to fruition. Are there simple things that people can do now to help it along? Can you offer some suggestions to simple steps people might be able to take?
There's so many things you can do. I mean, for me personally, one of the things I really love is that, and again, you do have to spend a little bit of money for this, but the ability actually to control some of this stuff with my voice. And particularly when you're running around after kids, as I am, or grandkids maybe, the ability to actually get some help, whether that's setting an alarm, setting a timer, calling somebody, or turning the heating up when you're cold, if you don't want to get off the sofa. That combination of the voice technology and this sort of smart home, that certainly does feel like you're living in Star Trek.
Right. Where can people find out more about all this?
So hivehome.com with loads of information about all this technology and predictions. And actually, I'm on social media. If you're on Twitter, find me at Book of the Future. I'm tweeting out 7 predictions today for the future smart home.
Could you just tell me who Hive are?
Hive is a smart home technology company. They provide this whole sort of ecosystem of parts, from controlling your heating to smart lighting, so you can set the mood for watching a film or set the lights to come on when you're out so it looks like you're in. Smart alarm systems, even leak monitoring. That's one that particularly appeals to me, given the age of my plumbing, so that you get an alert if your home is using more water than normal.
And presumably there are other companies out there who are doing a similar job.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the smart home market's grown enormously over the last 20 years as more and more people have adopted it because they've seen the benefits.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Tom. It's certainly a brave new world out there.
We can but hope.
Hope it lives up to your predictions. Thanks very much.
Cheers. Nice to meet you.
I was talking to Tom Cheesewright about developments that are likely to occur in the next 10 years, and particularly the smart home. If you'd like to find out more, there are two websites you can go to. One of them is www.hivehome.com. And that's hive as in bees, H-I-V-E. That's www.hivehome.com. And there's also Tom Cheesewright's personal website, which is just tomcheesewright.com. He's also on Twitter, and his address on Twitter is @BookOfTheFuture. That's @BookOfTheFuture. And now on to a rather less cheerful subject. I think we must all agree that last year has been a difficult one for all of us, with the changing world brought about by the COVID-19 pandemic encouraging many of us to reassess our own personal circumstances and change our outlook on life. New research just released by one of the UK's oldest funeral directors, who are now in their 10th generation of a family-run business, reveals that many of us have thought about how we'd like to be remembered when we've died. To find out more, I spoke to Jeremy Field. Now, the firm he works for is called CPJ Field, but it also goes by the name of Attrey and Kent, which, of course, is a name well known in Brighton. So I began by asking him to explain this.
Well, CPJ is a family company and has been for 300 years, but in Brighton and Hove, we're Attrey and Kent. Attrey and Kent have been in Brighton since the 18th century.
Now, what I wanted to ask you about was this new research that's just been completed. Yeah. Who was it conducted by?
CPJ Field. We put the research out.
One of the things it shows is that the attitudes of people to how they'd like to be remembered after their death has changed over the last few years. How did people want to be remembered in the past, you know, before the changes happened?
Well, I think our experience in arranging funerals has said that maybe people didn't think quite so much about that. Death has traditionally been a bit of a taboo subject. So I go so far as to say they probably hadn't thought about it. For us at CPJ Field, one of the surprising things about this research was actually the number of people that have had the conversation, given that the assumption is our society is one that wouldn't. I think it was more than 50% had the conversation, and 6 out of 10 had some thoughts about how they'd like to be remembered.
Yes, I suppose we don't like to be reminded of our own mortality, do we?
No, but I think that's one of the legacies of the last 12 months is that on a daily basis, we have had the death rate reported on the television news, which has, I suspect, fed an increase in the number of people that have thought about it just by it being part of our daily narrative as much as perhaps we would have preferred if it hadn't been.
So what sort of things did the survey find?
Well, a number of interesting things are the way that people have thought about the way that they want to be remembered, that so many people want to be remembered as someone who is genuine. Well over half want to be remembered as someone who is a good friend. 85% of respondents wanted people to reflect that they've made a positive impact on the communities in which they live. And I think for us as funeral directors, you know, it's so intrinsically linked to the lives of the communities in which we live, and you know, determined to try to look after the living as much as we do our work for the dead. That really resonated.
Yes, it seems to be a notable lack of people who'd like to be remembered for making a success of a huge business or venture or something.
I think it's maybe interesting that for this research, some of the people responding were towards the latter part of their lives. And perhaps as context comes upon us, we become less concerned about accumulating stuff. And there's some interesting things in here about having less regrets. There's some humour in regretting regrets, I guess. But the lesson is also, as it has been in so many different areas of the last year, about seizing the moment, making the most of the time we get to spend with friends and family, because I don't think any of us expected to have that taken away from us over the last 12 months. And we'll probably spend the rest of our lives making sure that we do everything to make sure it never happens again.
Yes, I noticed it says 53% wish that they had spent more time doing things that made them happy rather than what they think they should do.
I think certainly as a family man myself, I can really relate to a number of the points that come through here. But I find often doing those things for friends and family, and particularly for children at the time, if you don't get those things done, that's how you earn the right for that time. And I think it's interesting, isn't it? I think it was Steve Jobs who made the observation that if he'd have known that life would be cut so short, he would have spent a bit more time enjoying himself. I think it was said slightly snappier than that. But yes, Nonetheless, I think often what we do is spend a bit of time making the opportunity to be able to enjoy ourselves. But as I say, over the last year, we've all been reminded, I think, that work-life balance is critically important and something that we've been very focused on for all of our teams that have been so committed to making sure that families were looked after well over the last 12 months, that we're now keeping their well-being right at the heart of everything we do.
And of course, you never know when death is going to come, do you? I mean, that's something that the COVID pandemic has brought forward. We get some quite young people who you would have expected to live for many years longer, suddenly dying.
I think that's been probably one of the biggest challenges, you know, for the whole of our team. Families haven't expected to not be able to get together, to not gather, to have to go through some of these things on their own. And for some, that's been a blessing, more intimate funerals and maybe not necessarily worrying about catering for the 5,000. But at the same time, we want to feel that someone's life has mattered, no matter how long it was, and that they've made a contribution to the community of friends and family around them. And just being present for people for a funeral and admittedly the reception afterwards is one of the things we can do. And I like to think that as we look forward, that's something that we can do for other people and learn from the last 12 months.
Has your research been published? And if so, can people get hold of copies of the report?
Yeah, absolutely. Just go to our website, cpjfield, that's cpjfield.co.uk, and you'll find all the research on there. And there's lots of other great resources on there around how to have conversations relating to your funeral. If you have the conversation and you give the answers to some of the big questions, it doesn't need to be in the detail. The research itself said, don't sweat the small stuff so much. But we know for families that when they come to see us, knowing the answers to big questions, was the person religious? Do they want to be buried or cremated? Then that can bring a lot of peace to families and it's well worth doing.
What's the best way of making known your wishes concerning the funeral? Would it be in a will?
It's an interesting point. A will is a place where you can note that down. It's not binding on your executors. I think a will is a really important thing to have in place. It creates a lot of clarity about who is the right person to arrange the funeral, which can often lead to a little bit of family tension when there isn't clarity around that. But just note them down. It doesn't need to be in the will because, as I say, it's not binding in the will. So keep it as a fluid document. There is a funeral wishes form available on our website to do that, that takes you through some of those things, that music that's important to you, as I say, faith, if there was such a thing, or maybe a celebrant that you've experienced that you think does a great job. Record all that and put it somewhere safe, which is really, really important, but not nearly as important as telling someone where that somewhere safe is, in order that they may find it as and when the time comes. Some families have found it a comfort to email it to someone so that it can be stored somewhere and looked after.
Or you could leave it with your solicitor, I suppose, along with the will.
You could indeed. But again, if I may share the experience as a funeral director myself, as long as your surviving relatives know who your solicitor was, whatever it is you decide to do with it, have the conversation with someone else, share it, because then all of those things that make you unique can be drawn through into that funeral. I find one of the most fulfilling things in what we do is listening to the eulogies of people that I always, always wish had the chance to in life.
So I suppose the message is not to spend all your time worrying, but to make preparations well in advance so that things are all laid out well for your relatives and friends.
Absolutely. We're all about caring for the living. It's about making sure that you can get on with the rest of your life.
That's all very reassuring. Jeremy, thanks very much.
Sure, it's a pleasure to speak to you.
I was talking to Jeremy Field of the funeral directors, CPJ Field, about the survey that they recently conducted into how people would like to be remembered after their passing. If you'd like to find out more, and indeed if you'd like to get hold of a copy of their report, you can go to their website, www.cpjfield.co.uk. That's www.cpjfield.co.uk. Or you can phone them on 01273 542 454. So that's Brighton 542 454. Well, when you listen to a wonderful piece of orchestral music, do you sometimes wish that you could play a musical instrument? Brighton and Hove Music Service have just started a scheme of online instrumental music courses, which are open to anybody over the age of 18, regardless of any previous musical training that they may have had, or lack of it. To find out more, I spoke to Emma Collins and began by asking her what her job title is.
I'm the Learning and Partnerships Manager for Brighton and Hove Music and Arts and East Sussex Music. And together we're part of Brighton Dome and Brighton Festival. Historically, we're part of the City Council, and in 2017, we moved out of the council and joined with the Dome.
Is there a name for the scheme?
It's a campaign called Get Started. So we're working on a series of products and services for adults, which is new for our service. And we're branding it all Get Started.
And is it just music?
It's just music. We do other events during the year that are more multi-arts, but at the moment we're focusing on music for adult learners.
Is this a new scheme?
Yes, this is a new scheme. So we've worked for sort of over 15 years with children and young people, but this is the first time we've offered classes and activities specifically for adults.
And where did the idea come from?
Mainly from our parents, actually. Lots of the parents of children who learn with us had started to ask, particularly during lockdown, if there were opportunities for them to get involved. So we've been able, with the growth of online learning, to be able to offer this now for adults as well.
So this is basically open to anybody who isn't a child, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody aged over 18. We're particularly keen to encourage new learners, so adults who are trying it for the first time, but also people who might be picking up their instrument after leaving it in the loft for 20 years, or perhaps adults who would like some support to kind of continue progressing and developing their skills.
Of course, with the recent pandemic, with people being locked down and confined to the home a lot of the time, I suppose music is something that can help to take them out of themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, we found, certainly with our work with children and young people, we see the importance of music every day, the benefits of being able to connect, even if it's over the internet initially, but that importance of being able to connect with someone else, to share music, to make music and to express yourself. And one of the really important things for us about extending this work to adults is that we really believe it can enhance well-being and give everybody a boost at a time when they really need it. So if anyone was considering it, I would really urge them to take music up, because it can be such a wonderful thing for your overall well-being. And I think that's something that we can all benefit from at this difficult time.
And do they actually need any musical experience?
Absolutely not. We can cater from complete beginners through to more advanced students. So any level of experience or no experience is completely welcome.
And what instruments do you cover?
There's a big list. I had a look just before we spoke, actually. There's 18 different instruments listed on our website. So it includes drum kit, electric guitar, but also the full range of classical instruments as well. So strings, woodwind and brass, even specialist instruments like French horn, oboe and bassoon.
And it's all instrumental. There's no singing involved.
Actually, thank you for prompting me. There is singing as well. So we can offer individual singing tuition, and also we're offering an online singing and songwriting course at the moment.
That's very comprehensive. How are the lessons conducted?
At the moment, all of the lessons are happening online. So they're one-to-one lessons. We most often use Zoom, but there are other platforms available. But yeah, one-to-one online lessons that last for half an hour each week.
I was looking on the website and it mentioned group masterclasses and beginners self-paced videos as well.
Yes. So we've trying again for the first time to try and make it more flexible and give people more options. We've got some downloadable courses. So for ukulele, drum kit or guitar, you can download a series of 10 lessons which are self-paced and you work through on your own with video tuition and resources and help sheets and backing tracks. We're also running what we're calling masterclass courses. So they're 10-week courses in music production or singing and songwriting. So again, they're online, but they're for small groups of approximately 10 people at a time. And then there are the one-to-one online instrumental and vocal lessons.
Has it already started?
Yes, we launched just a few weeks ago now. So we've had a really positive response, particularly for the one-to-one lessons. And we've got a good number of people started, but we're really keen to recruit more and see this being an important part of our offer as we move forward.
And the big question, of course, how much does it cost?
The one-to-one lessons are £240 for a block of 10 lessons. And you would arrange with the teacher when they would be delivered. The downloadable courses are a much more affordable entry point, and they're $29.99.
Right. And you say you would arrange with the teacher when the lessons would be delivered. In other words, you would arrange a date and time when you and your tutor would get together online and have a lesson.
Yes, absolutely. Ideally, it would be at the same time each week. I don't know, for example, 5:30 every Monday. But we appreciate people have busy lives. So with notice, it's possible to have a bit of flexibility there as well.
And are there any grants available for this?
So we're not able to offer grants for adult learners at the moment, but there are charities out there that might be able to support. So, for example, there's a national charity called Music for All, which learners of any age can apply to for financial assistance.
So if people are interested in finding out more and taking up the scheme, how do they get more information?
You should definitely visit our website. So it's www.bhma.org. And on the front page, you'll see banners and photos with the Get Started name attached. So anything that says Get Started, you can click on that and there's more information about all of the different products and services for adults.
If people haven't got internet access, can they phone you?
They can. With the current situation with COVID, our office isn't open all of the time, but we are contactable on the phone. And the number for that would be 01273 261 565. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook and message us that way, and we can pick up messages in various different forms.
Have you had many people apply to it just yet?
Yes, so far we've got about 25 adult learners. So for the first few weeks, we were quite pleased with that, but we're really keen to promote more.
Is there any limit to the number of students you can take?
That's a really interesting question. On one level, I would say no. We have a really large teaching team of approximately 100 specialist instrumental tutors who work all over East Sussex and Brighton and Hove. But because these lessons take place online, you know, it doesn't really matter where the teacher lives or works. We can pair people according to their sort of instrumental specialism and availability. So we have a lot of teachers, and in theory, we could take a lot more adult learners.
Sounds like an excellent scheme. I hope it goes very well. Emma Collins, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I was talking to Emma Collins of Brighton and Hove Music Services about their online music courses, which are entitled Get Started. To find out more, you can go to their website, which is www.bhma.org.uk/get-started-music. That's bhma.org.uk/get-started-music. Or you can phone them on Brighton 261 565. That's 01273 261 565. And now here's Chris English to introduce the final item in our programme.
Now, we're told our love for the greater outdoors is here to stay. And fishing, would you believe, is on the up. Joining us to tell us all about it, Heidi Stone, Fisheries Partnerships Manager at the Environment Agency. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
And is that true? Is fishing once more on the up?
We think it is. COVID has been beneficial for angling, I think it's fair to say. We sold about 16% more rod licences last year. Well over a million licences were sold. So, yes, we're definitely on a bit of an up at the moment, and long may it continue.
And with those licences, does everybody who wants to throw their fishing tackle into the water need a licence?
Yes, you do. You do need a rod licence. You may need to pay for to fish a canal, but if you're over the age of 16, you need a rod licence. If you're under the age of 16, it's free. And if you're under 13, you don't need a licence.
Well, and where can people get those licences?
You can buy a rod licence online. If you go for fishing licences, gov.uk, you'll find our rod licence buying section. Please be warned, your listeners, there are places where you can go online and you'll be charged an administration fee. We all know those sites, so be warned of those ones. But yes, it's very, very easy to buy. You can get them at a post office as well, if you prefer to do that. And you can do a telesales line, but the online stuff only takes a couple of minutes.
And is it very expensive?
It is not. I don't think it is. It's £30 for a year. And a one-day license, if you wanted to try, is £6.
Wow. So what sort of people are fishermen and fisherwomen these days?
Well, the ladies are catching up on the men to some extent, Chris, I'm pleased to say. 22% of the first-time ever angling people last year were female, according to a survey that we've just run, which is, you know, a really, really positive sign. And I think it reflects that people just want to connect back with nature. And it's something you can just do by yourself for a few hours. So I think the popularity is definitely increasing.
Now, a lot of people in this neck of the woods here in Brighton will fish off the beach or off the outer walls of the marina. They still need a license?
No, they don't. If you're sea angling, you don't need a license. Not for me anyway, not from the Environment Agency.
So what makes the difference?
We don't regulate the fisheries in the marine environment. We regulate the freshwater fisheries. And the money we get from the rod license is reinvested back into fisheries. It does not go to government. We reinvest the income back into angling projects, fisheries habitat improvements, fish passes, and we work with others to get the best bang for our buck. So we changed, for instance, about £1.3 million of rod license income last year to £3.5 million of projects. So it's doing a really good job for everything, not just the fish and the anglers.
So if you went upriver on the Ouse or the Ada near to Brighton, you do need a licence. But if you go in the sea, you don't. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And the licence allows you to catch fish and take it home and clean it and eat it?
Freshwater fishing, generally speaking, you catch for recreational pleasure. The vast majority of people put them back, and local clubs probably have rules that ask you to put them back, which is probably quite different to the sea fishing community, where you generally take them home with your tea and add your chips to it.
Right. And just to clarify matters, with people that are wanting to take up fishing, is it expensive to buy the equipment?
No, it's not. It's a myth. You can, like all hobbies, you know, really go to town on it. But, you know, £5, £6, £7 at your local tackle shop will buy you a pole and the fishing line, which can be bought ready tied. You just have to hook it on, and a bit of bait will set you off. My friends who go fishing more than myself, they take them for their children. They have a great time with them and their grandchildren. It's very, very easy to do, very cheap. And we actually have this year, I think, Chris, a lot of people have refound that hobby. So we may have done it as a child, and they're, you know, it's been quite challenging last year with not much to do, and people just need to reconnect. They found that kit stashed in the back of the garage, and they've gone out and they've rediscovered their love of angling. And a lot of older people have been taking grandchildren, which is lovely.
Now, of course, there's more to the great outdoors than fishing and angling. So what else is there for people to do?
Our research has shown, as well as angling, those connecting with nature is getting a really good look in. Gardening, bird watching, hiking, they all came up really highly in the surveys that we've been doing. So they're definitely up there with fishing.
And what about the future of all water sports, including fishing? Do you think that's secure under the new Brexit system?
I don't think Brexit's got a lot to do with the recreational pass. If you like to do something, I think you'll want to do it. I think staying at home this year is going to encourage people to look around further to see what they can do closer to their home. And I think angling may well feature very strongly in that.
And of course, it's outdoors, which we're told we should be doing, and in the fresh air.
It is. And you can do it by yourself or you can do it with others. So as far as keeping yourself safe, it's a pretty good way of doing it.
Wonderful. Heidi, thank you very much for joining us. And is there a website that people can go on to get more details?
The latest guidance on rod licensing can be found at gov.uk, and I would recommend you search Angling Trust. That will take you to their website, and that will give you loads of information about what's available near you. Thanks, Chris.
Chris English was talking to Heidi Sohn about the upsurge of interest in fishing that's occurred during the pandemic. If you want to find out how to get a fishing licence, you can go to www.gov.uk/fishing-licenses. That's www.gov.uk/fishing-licenses. And that licence covers you for fishing on inland waters. As far as we know, you don't need a licence for fishing in the sea, which I'm sure is good news for people in our area. For more information about freshwater fishing, you can go to the website run by the Angling Trust, which is just at anglingtrust.net. That's anglingtrust, typed all as one word with no spaces, .net. Or you can phone them on 01568 620447. That's 01568 620447. Well, that almost brings us to the end of this edition of At Home This Morning. But before we go, I'd just like to remind you that, as you may have heard on other programmes on Radio Reverb, this year's Brighton Early Music Festival is about to start. It actually runs from the 5th of June to the 11th of July, and it's at weekends only. This year, because of the COVID restrictions, nearly all the events are going to be outdoors. And they're taking place at the Royal Spa in Queen's Park in Brighton. For more details, you can go to the BREMF website, which is at bremf.org.uk. That's bremf.org.uk. Or you can phone Brighton 833-746. That's 01273-833-746. It now only remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Reverb, to thank everyone who's taken part, to thank you for listening, and until we meet again, to wish you all the very best. Goodbye.